For CD's headlines this hour, the Yemeni Ansar Allah movement reacts to the visit of an American military delegation to Yemen, warning of US attempts to create tensions in the country. World leaders are gathering in Egypt for the UN climate summit, COP27, amid calls for rich countries to provide funding to other nations vulnerable to climate change. Humanitarian groups accuse Italy of breaking international law by refusing to let in immigrants plucked from the sea, pledging legal action against Rome. Hello and welcome. Many thanks for joining us. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement warns that the US and UK are preparing for a fresh round of escalation in the Arab country. A senior Ansar Allah official says several Western military delegations, including from the US, have visited Yemen over the past week. Ali Al-Ghahoum made the comments in an interview with Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen news network. Meanwhile, according to the Yemeni media, the US delegations are focused on the Hadramaut province to access its oil. Ansar Allah accuses Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies of plundering Yemen's oil and other natural resources. Recently, it launched a drone attack on a southern oil port. It said the attack was meant to deter attempts to steal Yemen's crude. US forces have been accused of stealing tens of tankers filled with Syrian oil from the country's northeast. Local sources in Yarubia countryside say a convoy of more than 40 tankers loaded with crude from wells occupied by American forces in Hasaka province left Syria through Mahmoudia crossing. They say the convoy entered neighboring Iraq later on. The development comes as the United States maintains its illegal presence in Syria despite objection from Damascus. Syria says the presence of US forces there is aimed at tightening their grip on Syrian oil wells and looting the country's resources. Iran's defense ministry has unveiled the upgraded Bavar 373 long-range missile system and launched Sayyad B-4 missile production line, Salman Khojouri reports.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sayyad B-4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at the range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement height has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers. In the past couple of years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in manufacturing different types of missiles to boost its defensive capabilities with the aim of protecting its territorial integrity and national sovereignty. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
World leaders are expected to meet in Egypt for COP27 climate talks with emissions cuts and funding to fight global warming high on the agenda. Some 110 heads of states and governments are expected to participate in the 2 days of UN talks in Sharm el-Sheikh. At the beginning of the ceremony on Sunday, delegates agreed to discuss provisions of funding on developing countries to fight the climate crisis caused by richer nations. Participating countries were also urged to adhere to their climate change obligations despite the financial crises they may be facing. The COP27 summit comes amid criticism that progress on curbing emissions has not been enough since the previous event in Scotland. To discuss this in more detail, we are joined by Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, via Skype from Auckland. Tony, many thanks for joining us. What do you have to say about this, and how do you think this can actually affect the climate change going forward? As you can see, there hasn't been much progress since the last event in Scotland.
Well, I think there has, because there's a lot of finances being diverted to this specific avenue of endeavour for humanity. Look at, for example, at the length of time this COP summit is going on for, nearly 2 weeks, and its budget, which is now, they're saying, around about $100 billion a year going into these various climate measures from the G7 countries and the richest countries. Although not everyone is paying up their fair share, apparently, lots of money is going into this. If just a fraction of that was going to the United Nations, for example, which only meets for 5 days a year, I think we'd see a UN which was much more capable. So this almost seems to be one of the places where the world leaders get come together, which is eclipsing the United Nations, rather like the World Economic Forum, because its budget is so much bigger. So there are 2 weeks there. And I think we also have to look at some of the vested interests. Obviously, King Charles is not going to be there this year. He said he's not going to anyway, although I know Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, has changed his mind. But you have to look at the vested interests that Charles has. In the Panama Papers, which came out in 2016, the investigative journalists around the world discovered that King Charles had a £100,000 stake that he put in a startup company which was making the initial stages towards the global carbon trading system. And so, you know, he's got a vested interest in this being a successful new way of doing things. I would say a very simple thing. We can plan to lessen pollution, but we shouldn't be trying to come up with a market solution. This market solution is simply a playing games, a kind of casino way of doing it. We just have to say, no, we have to do less of this. So there's also some controversy about to what extent climate change is being man-made, what extent the sun and other things have an effect on it. I think, you know, for me, I'm pretty clear that man does have quite a big effect on the climate, particularly China, because they are the big industrial power at the moment. But there are a lot of scientists that contend with this, and the mass media, certainly in Britain, shuts them out of the discussion, shuts them out of the debate. And for example, back in 2013, we heard the scientists themselves at the IPCC, the UN body that's responsible for all this, saying that the average temperature hasn't risen for the last 15 years, and we're going to have to massage up our report in order to try and make out that it has. So, you know, this all started really with the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, and we're now at a stage where the COP27 at Sharm el-Sheikh, which, by the way, is Tony Blair's favourite holiday destination. I'm not sure if he'll be popping up there somewhere. It has become one of the biggest and most important get-togethers in the world, where actually I think we should be also spending at least as much money on the United Nations and making sure that the UN has got some powers to stop some of the conflicts around the world, which are causing so much, probably more, I would say, death and destruction than climate change.
Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joining us from Auckland. Many thanks. Moving on now. Anger is simmering over Italy's refusal to let in migrants plucked from the sea. A German rescue charity organization says it will take legal action against the Italian government for violating international law. The organization says it will file petition in courts in two Italian cities of Rome and Catania. That after Italy barred around 200 migrants to get off a rescue ship in Catania. Prior to that, Italian authorities let in 144 vulnerable passengers on board a German-flagged vessel while refusing to accept others. Those allowed to disembark were children and the sick. The ship was then reordered to leave the port of Catania. Italy is now facing criticism for a selective approach toward receiving migrants. Human rights groups have called on Rome to stop discrimination. They say the law of the sea requires that all rescued migrants should be disembarked in a safe place. In the UK, public discontent with the government is lingering. Thousands from across the country descended upon the capital, London, on the weekend to protest against the country's worsening cost of living crisis and to demand a general election. Saidpur Reza has been to the protest and sent us this report.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction. It's led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises.
We're going backwards. You know, we've got hungry children. We've got old people living in like freezing cold flats, and it's terrible.
I think the reason for the massive inflation is all the money that they printed throughout COVID. 600 billion was printed through COVID, most of which ended up in the hands of rich people.
The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come.
I want to see a general election. I don't feel like the Tory party should be able to just put people into power, and especially because they're just keeping, inequality, the hostile environment. They're still putting cuts into our NHS and all our social services. So I just feel they don't really have a democratic mandate to do that. And I think it's important that the country has the right to choose who's in charge, not just the Tory party.
There's no democratic argument, despite the law, to say that we've had three prime ministers in the space of 3 months, in less than a quarter of a year, none of whom can offer any real solution to the problems we've got right now. And there's no excuse for that.
The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new prime minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saidpur Reza, London.
Moving on now, North Korea has vowed a, quote, sustained, resolute and overwhelming military response to the recent joint air drills by South Korea and the United States. The North Korean military said the war games were an open provocation aimed at intentionally escalating the tension. It added that the exercises were dangerous and of very high aggressive nature. The military noted that the situation grows more unstable due to what it called reckless military hysteria of Seoul and Washington. Last week, South Korea and the United States carried out their largest ever air drills for 6 days. Hundreds of warplanes, including US B-1B bombers, participated in the exercises. Washington and Seoul said the drills were in response to Pyongyang's launches of missiles and its possible plan to resume nuclear tests. Pyongyang, however, viewed the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles and more U.S. war games, a dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side, when the U.S. Air Force deployed the two B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less notice were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war, but our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent, even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land.
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction, and that could spell nuclear Armageddon.
The view from the White House and the U.S. allies in the region is that Pyongyang is looking for attention. They believe that North Korea is deliberately ramping up tensions with its neighbors to ultimately call for engagement and concessions from South Korea, Japan, and the United States. Yet there are doubts if that is really the case. Maybe another message is for the U.S. to leave that region altogether. Well, that brings us to the end of this news bulletin. Many thanks.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Dear passengers, welcome to Kashan.
This announcement means we have gone through half the way in our attractive journey to Yazd province. I am really eager to see Dolatabad Garden. You know, Persian gardens are very unique in the world. However, Dolatabad Garden is a jewel of Persian architecture. Must be a very different garden. Dolatabad Garden in Yazd, central Iran, is among the most iconic landscapes of Iran with distinctive properties, picture postcard views of water stream, and the historic Persian pavilions. The garden, which spans an area of 72,000 square meters, attracts a wide range of visitors to offer a memorable glimpse on the coexistence of ancient history and beautiful nature. This is one of the 9 Iranian gardens listed by UNESCO under the common title of Persian Gardens. The garden was built about 300 years ago as a residence for Muhammad Taghi Khan, also known as the Great Khan, who governed Yazd in the 18th century. The complex has been built according to the original Iranian architectural style and consists of a large garden and a number of buildings. Like other Persian gardens, water plays an important role in the ornamentation of the Dolatabad garden. There are several kanats, waterways, and ponds within the garden. The lush garden is a paradise where different trees like pine and cypress, various flowers like roses and fruit trees like grape and pomegranate abound, offering a green carpet panorama. This complex includes a southern frontispiece building, a vestibule building, and a wind catcher, a summer building, Behesht or Paradise building, a mirror hall building, the Tehrani building, the main frontispiece building, and a double-spanned water cistern. The soaring 34-meter-high wind catcher, the highest one in Iran, makes the state really unique, creating a spectacular vista. Dolatabad's famous wind catcher has octagonal panels that guide the wind inside the building.
Kindly attention, train to Yazd is arriving on time at platform number 4.
Taxi? My destination is Chahar Menar neighborhood. Dolatabad Garden, please. One of the old neighborhoods of Yazd is Chahar Menar neighborhood, located in the center of the city. Chahar Minar is an area that includes the largest historical texture of Yazd in terms of area. This neighborhood is the only historical neighborhood of Yazd, the monuments of which have been inscribed by UNESCO in two periods. Daulatabad Garden, along with eight other Iranian gardens, was the first place inscribed in 2011. Sir, is there a long way to Daulatabad Garden?
Not a long way to go. We usually have no traffic here in Yazd.
Well, here it is. I've heard that once this street was home to a lot of trees. Tall trees which overshadowed this garden. Oh, God. The wind catcher is appearing. Wow, look at it. Such wind catchers are only seen in Iran. It's about 34 meters. It's octagonal, which lets the wind be directed into the building in every way. The wind which enters the building strikes the pool's water and then creates cool air inside the building. Imagine such a cool place in the heart of the desert. And I love these fountains. What a nice feeling is to be here. Wish you were here, honestly. And let me tell you something interesting. The main source of water in this garden is Daulatabad Kanat, or as we Iranians say, Kanat. Water streams are flowing in almost all parts of the garden. It's amazing. Let me enter the vestibule building. Here is actually the main pavilion of the garden and is mostly considered by its tall wind catcher. There is a marble pool in the middle of the pavilion. It's beautiful. And three spacious chambers. Oh, I love the arches of these windows and these colorful glasses. Oh, fascinating. I wish I lived in such a place for my whole life. This is just one of the pavilions of the garden. I wish I could describe all these beauties for you, but as they say, art is long, but time is short. Without any exaggeration, nowhere does have such amazing monuments like my beautiful Iran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the Spotlight.
The Western hype over Iran providing Russia with drones was recently explained with any ambiguous details, which was clarified by the Iranian foreign minister. He said that Iran has provided Russia with a limited number of drones months before the war in Ukraine. Nevertheless, the Ukrainian president has argued against that and is pushing for sanctions against Iran, even threatening Iran militarily. Ironically, it has been the U.S. and its NATO member allies that have been fueling the war by providing Ukraine with weapons and with military assistance. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Gilbert Doctorow is an independent international affairs analyst joining us from Brussels. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you. Taking a look at what Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has said about this, and I'm going to quote him, Iran has provided Russia with a limited number of drones months before the war in Ukraine. Of course, he has said other things, too, which we'll get into. What is your initial reaction on this particular revelation by the Iranian Foreign Minister?
Well, it's very, very good that a statement like this has been made. At the same time, the overall position of Iran and of Russia as well is to deny that Iran is providing assistance to the Russian war effort in Ukraine. I don't call anybody a liar. The little polite lies are the currency, the common currency of diplomacy on all sides. It has been that way in the past, it's that way in the present, and will be in the future. So it is not necessary to stop at this statement that was made today. I think it's reasonable to say that Iran has facilitated Russian use of drones in one way or another, whether by supplying complete drones or providing the license for production of those drones in Russia. There is little doubt in my mind that Iran is facilitating the Russian effort and that this contribution by Iran is enormously important in putting a quick end to this war. The drones have been used by the Russians primarily in their destruction of infrastructure of the electricity generation and distribution. The Ukrainians now report that 40% of their national generation of electricity has been destroyed. The drones are unique in their ability to get through the Ukrainian air defenses, which in some cities like Kiev have been very well developed. The drones are by nature rather inexpensive, and if you use missiles in your anti-attack systems, you are spending a great deal of money to chase a very low-cost attacker. Moreover, the systems that are in place to down Russian cruise missiles are simply not adapted or suitable for downing drones. So the drones have gotten in, they've done their work, and the destruction of the energy generation and distribution in Ukraine is at the present moment a very important avenue for ending the war quickly. Today, Mr. Zelensky was reported as saying that that in case electricity is cut off completely in Ukraine, in Kiev, that is, and this is entirely possible in the coming days and weeks, then 3 million people will have to be evacuated. This is quite extraordinary as a statement. It is totally irresponsible and unrealizable, but nonetheless, it indicates the desperation of the Kievan regime. A total blackout, which is foreseeable, according to the latest statements by those responsible for managing the national electricity grid in Ukraine, a total blackout is possible, and that would by itself greatly hamper, if not destroy entirely, the Ukrainian military force. It would disintegrate. A blackout would be decisive.
Okay. Again, just to clarify here, Marcus Papadopoulos, our guest there, talked about the use of these drones in the war. The official line from Iran is, and I'm going to quote our foreign minister, "I would like to emphasize that the fuss made by some Western countries that Iran has provided Russia with missiles and drones, claims about the missile part is completely wrong, and the drone part is correct," again, provided the months before the war in Ukraine. And there was supposed to be a meeting, according to our foreign minister, to explain this to the Ukrainian side, but based on what he has said, the Ukrainian officials didn't show up because of European and Western pressure, because they said you can't sit around and have coffee with Iranian officials. What is your reaction to this?
Given that Iran has a strategic partnership with Russia, it is conceivable, and I emphasize the word conceivable, that Iran has either sent drones to Russia or shared drone technology with Russia during the Russian military's campaign in Ukraine. That all said, however, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has issued a statement refuting Western allegations that it has sent drones to Russia since the start of the Russian military campaign in Ukraine. Now, why should we dismiss the statement from the Iranian Foreign Ministry? Why? Because it is from the Iranian Foreign Ministry? Conversely, why should we treat as gospel each and every word that is spoken by Zelensky or another Ukrainian government official? Furthermore, why should we treat as gospel each and every word spoken by either a British or an American government official? That is a very important question which we have to highlight. And of course, the answer is quite simply this. Iran is a member of the United Nations. Iran is an independent sovereign country. Iran has dignity. The Iranians have issued a rebuttal. Therefore, the ball, so to speak, is now in the court of the West to supply concrete evidence that Iran has supplied the Russian army with drones since the 24th of February. However, if, let's say, theoretically, Iran has supplied the Russian army with drones since the start of Russia's campaign in Ukraine.
Okay.
Well, that would be no different to how America and Britain replenished the stocks of the Israeli military during Israel's numerous invasions of Lebanon. Also, it would be no different to how Britain and America replenishes the stocks of the Saudi Arabian military during Saudi Arabia's ongoing campaign in Yemen, which has caused the deaths of 400,000 Yemeni men, women, and children.
Sure, point taken. Gilbert Doctorow, so you're of the belief that these drones were actually used and they were very effective, even though, again, I have to make sure that I say this because I have to, and the Iranian line is not that. But is there a possibility that given the stage that this war is at and given the reaction that we have seen from the Ukrainian President Zelensky, which I'm sure is being also instructed to spew whatever lines it is from the U.S. and its NATO partner allies, that because they're not doing that well in this war, that they're using this as a scapegoat, and perhaps at the same time maybe demonizing Iran in this form and fashion?
Well, I'd like to respond to what you just asked, at the same time to take in the remarks of my fellow panelist as to who is saying this. I can tell you the Russians are saying this, not the official Russian government. But about 6 weeks ago, I heard on Russia's leading political talk show, the Vladimir Solovyov Evening Show, one of the panelists mentioned that, you know, we could really use military equipment from Iran, and we could really use military equipment from North Korea. And the first to be highlighted in the New York Times and the Financial Times has been the alleged delivery of drones to Russia from Iran. So I go back to the Russians saying this would be very nice if it happened. As for North Korea, we haven't heard anything about it until just about now. Russian media are explaining how North Korea has munitions which are very suitable for Russian use in artillery, because most of what North Korea produces is copies of equipment from the Soviet Union and China. We have heard allegations in the last 2 or 3 days that North Korea is supplying artillery munitions to Russia. Surprise, surprise. We have heard yesterday on Russian media that Russia is about to place orders for clothing, the military uniforms and so forth, from North Korea. So what was let out unofficially on Russian state television 6 weeks to 8 weeks ago about the intentions of receiving, of procuring relevant equipment from Iran and from North Korea is, I'd say, being realized. It's not an allegation that's coming out of thin air.
Mm. Well, at the same time, Marcus Papadopoulos, what does that say when they are, again, if it's all alleged here, but if it were to be true, how all these months, I think it's 9 months or more now, that the U.S. and its NATO partners have been pumping military aid and weapons and equipment of all kinds, and yet you're having them be at the state that they are in now, in terms of whatever power, if you want to say, has been decreased from their military might, even after all this time. What does that say about the state of affairs militarily for Ukraine?
I have said, ever since the Russian army commenced its military campaign in Ukraine, that Russia is winning the war and that Russia will emerge victorious. I have also said that the state of that Ukraine will cease to exist, or a rump stake of Ukraine will be left. And that rump stake will comprise the westernmost part of the country, Lvov, Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, Volyn, and Rivne. The Russian industrial military complex is absolutely enormous. Russia has armaments factories which are the size of small towns. I suggest people research the Russian city of Magnitorsk, which is adjacent to the Russian-Kazakh border. There, in that one city alone, which is virtually an armaments city, that city can replenish any losses that the Russian military incur in terms of weaponry in a very short period of time. So if Russia is buying military equipment from either Iran or North Korea, then this military equipment will amount to a very small percentage of the overall equipment which the Russian military is deploying in Ukraine. The Russians in storage have thousands and thousands of tanks. Russia can call up, if need be, 25 million soldiers. Russia is a military superpower. Russia, therefore, does not need Iran, does not need North Korea to win this war. And as you have said on a number of occasions so far during this discussion, the audacity of the Americans and the British and the European Union to criticize Iran for allegedly supplying weapons to Russia in this conflict is quite remarkable,
right,
given the amount of weaponry that the West has poured into Ukraine, so much so that the Canadian military and the German military have depleted their own stockpiles.
Sure. All right, so Gilbert, just a very simple question over here. I think the U.S. pledged another close to $500 million in military assistance. What if that stopped? What if U.S. and the NATO countries just didn't provide any weapons, and they said, "Okay, let's talk." Why is that not happening?
It's not happening because of the United States. The United States dictates to its NATO allies what the official line will be, and they act accordingly. The United States is hoping, has been since February, to use the Ukraine conflict to wear down Russian military strength and to deplete its officer caste and its capability of waging major war on the ground. That has been the hope, and it has not yet been abandoned. The Biden administration has made this part of its official policy. It stands by that, and pending a reversal in the midterm elections this week, it will continue to be obstinate and to resist negotiations. As for the situation within Ukraine, I agree substantially with the remarks made by my fellow panelist, except for the very beginning of this special military operation. It got off to a bad start. It got off to a bad start because there clearly were serious errors in the military intelligence which was being fed to the Kremlin. The expectation was that Kiev would fold, that the population would come out with flowers to meet the Russian tanks. That was way off base, and it failed to take into account the remaking of the Ukrainian military force and the remaking of Ukraine's national identity in the last 8 years under the close supervision of the United States and its NATO allies. However, after this initial setback, which unfortunately gave a bad signal to Western military observers that Russia was weak and incapable, after that initial setback, Russia refound its balance, repositioned itself, first for a war of attrition, and then after the various terrorist attacks of several weeks ago, it took off the gloves and it moved from what is essentially a limited military operation to open warfare. The destruction, with the help of drones, whoever's drones they may be, the destruction of the electric grid has great importance for destroying the fighting morale of the Ukrainian nation, but more importantly, for interrupting the logistics of supply. Because in answer to one of your questions earlier, without the steady stream of armaments coming from the West through Poland and into Lvov, and then by rail across Ukraine to the several front lines in the east and south of the country. Without that steady flow, the Ukrainian military is finished, kaput. It doesn't have reserves of arms to maintain its positions.
Sure. Well, the gains that the U.S. is making here is rather quickly coming into light, Marcus Papadopoulos. We've all said, and I think you agree, that obviously the U.S. arms manufacturers are reaping fantastic profits on this. That much is well known. But now we're looking at the U.S.'s economic interests. And in particular, we're looking how that is coming at the cost of the European Union. Reports now coming at how there's a deindustrialization happening. We are having factories being relocated to the U.S. Not relocated. They're opting to open up their factories in the U.S. because of the high energy prices combined with the incentives from this inflation Reduction Act that the U.S. passed. So much so that you had Germany and France, who were at odds on certain issues, to unite and telling the U.S., you better do something about this. And then, of course, we have the visit of the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to China with an economic delegation to shake hands on solidifying their trade interests and enhancing that. Are we looking at now the EU waking up to what's going on?
I can only hope, but I doubt, however, that the European Union will be able to free itself of its American shackles. The Americans have seized an opportunity to eradicate the European Union's trade relationship with Russia. And instead, the Americans are now making the European Union beholden on trade and energy supplies with America, which demonstrates how America treats its own friends and allies. One would expect the Americans to attempt to destroy the Russian economy. After all, Russia is an adversary to America. But look at how the Americans treat the European Union. The European Union is a strategic ally to America.
Sure.
And most EU members are members of NATO. And still, the Americans are prepared to see European industries destroyed.
I got to squeeze in a question here. Sorry to jump in to Gilbert Doctorow, which is going to be the same question. Are we looking at the EU doing a turnaround when it comes to the U.S. and this war? Under a minute, please.
I think, depending on the outcome of the elections on November 8th, it's very likely the United States will be doing a turnaround on Europe. It's very likely that should the Democrats lose control of the Congress, the United States will no longer be supplying Ukraine with military and financial assistance, not because of some humanitarian concerns, not because they have bleeding hearts for the tens of thousands of Ukrainian males who are dying on the battlefield and in an unnecessary war that is prolonged by American arms deliveries. No. They will renounce further aid to Ukraine on strictly financial considerations of the state of the United States economy.
Okay.
The inflation that has hit Europe at over 10% has hit the United States at under 10%, but still at decades-long high levels.
Thank you.
And that Ukraine, that is resulting in prime rate increases. The prime rate increases result in heavier borrowing costs.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We just don't have the time. Okay. And I thank you for that. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you, historian, political analyst, and author from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tarvey and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the role that the clerics and the clergymen might have in politics. According to Islamic theology and Islamic teachings, is it at all allowed for a religious scholar, like a faqih, like a clergyman, like a cleric, to interfere in political affairs of a society or, for example, have some political positions or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that I think first of all we should make it clear that what do we mean by politics? If we do mean by politics, Machiavellistic politics, of course, not only the religion of Islam, rather all Abrahamic religions are far from these kind of politics. What do we mean by that? For example, they mean that whatever you can do, you know, actually goals justify the means. Okay.
Yes.
If you want to rule over people, what is the goal? Means that if you want to rule over people, you may do whatever and you may use whatever means you have in order to reach to your governments over people. Or, for example, politics has no limitation and does not have any ethical rule within it. You know, these are some of the rulings of Machiavelli. And, of course, you may do, whatever evil action in order to safeguard your government. Yes. These are some of the rules of, some of the philosophy of Machiavelli for the politics. If we mean by the politics these kind of politics, which is not, mentioning whatever, any rights for people, disregard all rights of individual and people, actually, these kind of politics, all religions, all Abrahamic religion are far from that. But if we mean Alawi politics, attributing of to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, especially if you go to the statements of Imam Ali in Nahjul Balagha, describing the position of government and ruler over people, actually our religion has many description and ideas with regards to that politics.
But the main question over here is that, and what are the main features of this Islamic government? I mean, if we want to differentiate between a secular one and an Islamic one, on the head of the which is, for example, Islamic clergyman or a Muslim